The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I'll read a short story by Nicole Krauss and an article by Jill Lepore on the effects of living indoors. And now, from the September 21st, 2020 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the fiction section, Switzerland, by Nicole Krauss. It's been 30 years since I saw Soraya. In that time, I tried to find her only once. I think I was afraid of seeing her, afraid of trying to understand her now that I was older and maybe could, which I suppose is the same as saying that I was afraid of myself, of what I might discover beneath my understanding. The years passed, and I thought of her less and less, and I went to university and then graduate school, got married sooner than I'd imagined, and had two daughters, only a year apart. If Soraya had came to mind at all, flickering past in a mercurial chain of associations, she would recede again just as quickly. I met Soraya when I was 13, the year that my family spent abroad in Switzerland. Expect the worst might have been the family motto, had my father not explicitly instructed us that it was, trust no one, suspect everyone. We lived on the edge of a cliff, though our house was impressive. We were European Jews, even in America, which is to say that catastrophic things had happened and might happen again. Our parents fought violently, their marriage forever on the verge of collapse. Financial ruin also loomed. We were warned that the house would soon have to be sold. No money had come in since our father left the family business, after years of daily screaming battles with our grandfather. When our father went back to school, I was 2, my brother 4, and my sister yet to be born. Pre-med courses were followed by medical school at Columbia, then a residency in orthopedic surgery at the Hospital for Special Surgery, though what kind of special we didn't know. During those 11 years of training, my father logged countless nights on call in the emergency room, greeting a grisly parade of victims, car crashes, motorcycle accidents, and once the crash of an Avianca airplane headed for Bogota, which nosedived into a hill in Cove Neck. At bottom, he may have clung to the superstitious belief that these nightly confrontations with horror could save his family from it. But one stormy September afternoon, my grandmother was hit by a speeding van at the corner of First Avenue and 50th Street, causing hemorrhaging in her brain. When my father got to Bellevue Hospital, his mother was lying on a stretcher in the emergency room. She squeezed his hand and slipped into a coma. 6 weeks later, she died. Less than a year after her death, my father finished his residency and moved our family to Switzerland, where he began a fellowship in trauma. That Switzerland, neutral, alpine, orderly, has the best institute for trauma in the world, seems paradoxical. The whole country had, back then, the atmosphere of a sanitarium or of an asylum. Instead of padded walls, it had the snow, which muffled and softened everything. Until after so many centuries, the Swiss just went about instinctively muffling themselves. Or that was the point, a country singularly obsessed with controlled reserve and conformity, with engineering watches, with the promptness of trains, would, it follows, have an advantage in the emergency of a body smashed to pieces. That Switzerland is also a country of many languages was what granted my brother and me an unexpected reprieve from the familial gloom. The institute was in Basel, where the language is Schweizerdeutsch, but my mother was of the opinion that we should continue our French. Schweizerdeutsch was only a hairbreadth removed from Deutsch, and we were not allowed to touch anything even remotely Deutsch, the language of our maternal grandmother, whose entire family had been murdered by the Nazis. We were therefore enrolled in the École Internationale in Geneva. My brother lived in the dormitory on campus, but as I just barely turned 13, I wasn't old enough. To save me from the traumas associated with Deutsch, a solution was found for me on the western outskirts of Geneva. And in September 1987, I became a boarder in the home of a substitute English teacher named Mrs. Elderfield. She had hair dyed the color of straw and the rosy cheeks of someone raised in a damp climate. But she seemed old, all the same. My small bedroom had a window that looked onto an apple tree. On the day that I arrived, red apples were fallen all around it, rotting in the autumn sun. Inside the room was a little desk, a reading chair, and a bed at whose foot was folded a gray woolen army blanket old enough to have been used in a world war. The brown carpet was worn down to the weave at the threshold. Two other boarders, both 18, shared the back bedroom at the end of the hall. All three of our narrow beds had once belonged to Mrs. Elderfield's sons, who had grown up and moved away long before we girls arrived. There were no photographs of her boys, so we never knew what they looked like, but we rarely forgot that they had once slept in our beds. Between Mrs. Elderfield's absent sons and us, there was a carnal link. There was never any mention of Mrs. Elderfeld's husband, if she'd ever had one. She was not the sort of person who invited personal questions. When it was time to sleep, she switched off our lights without a word. On my first evening in the house, I sat on the floor of the older girls' room among their pile of clothes. Back home, girls sprayed themselves with a cheap men's cologne called Drakkar Noir. The strong perfume that permeated these girls' clothes was unfamiliar to me. Mixed with the chemistry of their skin, it mellowed, but from time to time it built up so strongly in their bedsheets and tossed off shirts that Mrs. Elderfield forced open the windows and the cold air once again stripped everything bare. I listened as the older girls discussed their lives in coded words I didn't understand. They laughed at my naivete, but they were only ever kind to me. Marie had come from Bangkok via Boston, and Zoria from Tehran via the 16th Andrassement of Paris. Her father had been the royal engineer to the Shah before the revolution sent their family into exile. Too late to pack Zoria's toys, but in time to transfer most of their liquid assets. Wildness. Sex stimulants, a refusal to comply, was what I had landed them both in Switzerland for an extra year of school, a 13th year that neither of them had ever heard of. We used to get out for school in the dark. To get to the bus stop, we had to cross a field, which by November was covered in snow that the sheared brown stalks sorted through. We were always late. I was always the only one who'd eaten. Someone's hair was always wet, the ends frozen. We huddled in the enclosure, inhaling secondhand smoke from Soria's cigarette. The bus took us past the Armenian church to the orange tram. Then it was a long ride to the school on the other side of the city. Because of our different schedules, we rode back alone. Only on the first day, at Mrs. Elderfield's insistence, did Marie and I meet up to travel together. But we took the tram in the wrong direction and ended up in France. After that, I learned the way, and I usually broke up the journey by dropping in the tobacco shop next to the tram stop, where before catching the bus, I bought myself some candy from the open containers that, according to my mother, were crawling with strangers' germs. I'd never been so happy or so free. It wasn't only the difficult and anxious atmosphere of my family that I'd got away from, but also my miserable school back home, with its petty, hormonal girls, Olympic in their cruelty. I was too young for a driver's license, so there was never any means of escape except through books or walks in the woods behind our house. Now, I spent the hours after school wandering the city of Geneva. I often ended up by the lake, where I watched the tourist cruises come and go, or I invented stories about the people I saw, especially the ones who came to make out on the benches. Sometimes I tried on clothes at H&M, or wandered around the old city, where I was drawn back to the imposing monument, to the Reformation, to the inscrutable faces of towering stone Protestants of whose names I can only recall John Calvin's. I hadn't yet heard of Borges, and had yet had no other time in my life was I closer to the Argentine writer who had died in Geneva the year before, and who, in a letter explaining his wish to be buried in his adopted city, wrote that he had always felt mysteriously happy. Years later, a friend gave me Borges' Atlas, and I was startled to see a huge photo of those somber giants I used to visit. Anti-Semites all, who believed in predestination and the absolute sovereignty of God. In it, John Calvin leaned slightly forward to gaze down at the blind Borges, seated on a stone ledge holding his cane, chin tilted upward. Between John Calvin and Borges, the photo seemed to say that there was a great attunement. There was no attunement between John Calvin and me, but I, too, had sat on that ledge, looking up at him. Sometimes in my wanderings, a man would stare at me without letting up, or come on to me in French. These brief encounters embarrassed me and left me with a feeling of shame. Often the men were African, with sparkling white smiles. But one time, as I stood looking into the window of a chocolate shop, a European man in a beautiful suit came up behind me. He leaned in, his face touching my hair, and in faintly accented English whispered, "I could break you in two with one hand." Then he continued on his way, very calmly, as if he were a boat sailing on still water. I ran all the way to the tram stop, where I stood gasping for breath until the tram arrived and squeaked mercifully to a stop. We were expected at the dinner table at 6:30 sharp. The wall behind Mrs. Elderfeld's seat was hung with small oil paintings of Alpine scenes, and even now an image of a chalet or cows with bells or some Heidi gathering berries in her checked apron brings back the aroma of fish and boiled potatoes. Very little was said during those dinners, or maybe it only seemed so in comparison with how much was said in the back bedroom. Marie's father had met her mother in Bangkok while he was a GI and had brought her to America, where he set her up with a Cadillac Seville and a ranch house in Silver Spring, Maryland. When they divorced, her mother returned to Thailand, her father moved to Boston, and for the next 10 years, Marie was tossed and tugged between them. For the past few years, she had lived exclusively with her mother in Bangkok, where she had a boyfriend, with whom she was madly, jealously in love, and would stay out with him all night, dancing in clubs, drunk or high. When Marie's mother, at her wit's end and busy with her own boyfriend, told Marie's father about the situation, he yanked her out of Thailand and deposited her in Switzerland, known for its finishing schools, that polished the wild and dark out of girls and contained them into well-mannered women. Ecolint was not such a school, but Marie, it turned out, was already too old for a proper finishing school. She was, in the estimation of those schools, already finished. And not in a good way. So instead, Marie was sent to do an extra year of high school at Ecolint. Along with Mrs. Elderfield's house rules, there were strict instructions from Marie's father about her curfew. And after Marie got into Mrs. Elderfield's cooking wine, those stringent regulations were tightened even further. Because of this, on the weekends that I did not take the train to Basel to see my parents, Marie and I were often home together, while Soria was out. Unlike Marie, Soria didn't radiate trouble, at least not the sort of trouble that comes of recklessness, of a desire to cross whatever boundaries or limits others have set for you. without consideration of the consequences. If anything, Soroya radiated a sense of authority, exquisite because it derived from an inner source. Her outward appearance was neat and composed. She was small, no taller than I was, and wore her dark straight hair cut in what she called a channel bob. Chanel bob. Her eyes were winged with eyeliner, and she had a downy mustache that she made no effort to conceal, because she must have known that it added to her allure. She always spoke in a low voice, as if she trafficked in secrets, a habit she may have formed during her childhood in revolutionary Iran, or in her adolescence, when her appetite for boys, and then men, quickly outgrew what was considered acceptable by her family. On Sundays, when there wasn't much to do, the three of us would spend the day closed up in the back bedroom listening to cassettes and, in that low-slung voice further deepened by smoking, descriptions of the men Soroya had been with and the things she'd done with them. If these accounts didn't shock me, it was partly because I didn't yet have a solid enough sense of sex, let alone the erotic, to really know what to expect from it. But it was also because of the coolness with which Soroya told her stories. She had about her a kind of unassailability. And yet, I suppose she felt the need to test whatever it was at her core that had come to her, like all natural gifts, without effort, and what might happen if it failed her. The sex she described seemed to have little to do with pleasure. On the contrary, it was as if she were submitting herself to a trial. Only when Tehran was woven into her discursive stories and she recounted her memories of that city was her sense of pleasure truly palpable. November, after the arrival of the snow, it must have been November already when the businessman showed up in our conversations. Dutch, more than twice Soria's age, he lived in a house with no curtains on an Amsterdam canal, but every couple of weeks he came to Geneva on business. A banker, as I recall. The lack of curtains, I remember, because he told Soroya that he only made love to his wife with the lights on when he was sure that people across the Herengracht could see her. He stayed at the Hotel Royal, and it was in the restaurant of that hotel, where her uncle had taken her for tea, that Soroya first met him. He was sitting a few tables away, and while her uncle droned on in Farsi about all the money his children spent, Soroya watched the banker delicately debone his fish. Wielding his utensils with precision, a look of absolute calm on his face, the man extracted the skeleton whole. He performed the operation perfectly, slowly, with no sign of hunger. Not once, as he proceeded to devour the fish, did he stop to remove a small bone from his mouth, the way everyone does. He ate his fish without choking, without even making a passing grimace of displeasure at being speared in the throat by a tiny, errant bone. It takes a certain kind of man to turn what is essentially an act of violence into elegance. While Soroya's uncle was in the men's room, the man called for his check, paid in cash, and rose to leave, buttoning his sports jacket. But instead of going straight out the doors that led to the lobby, he detoured past Soroya's table, on which he dropped a 500-franc note. His room number was written in blue ink next to Albrecht von Haller's face, as if it were Albrecht von Haller who was affording her this bit of precious information. Later, while she was kneeling on his old hotel bed, freezing in the cold gusting in through the open terrace doors, the banker told her that he always got a room overlooking the lake, because the powerful stream of its fountain, which shot up hundreds of feet into the air, aroused him. As she repeated this to us, lying flat on the floor with her feet up on the twin bed of Mrs. Elderfeld's son, she laughed and couldn't stop. And yet, despite the laughter, an arrangement had been made. From then on, if the banker wished to let Soroya know of his impending arrival, he would call Mrs. Elderfield's house and pretend to be her uncle. the 500-franc note Zoria put away in the drawer of her night table. At the time, Zoria was seeing other men. There was a boy her age, the son of a diplomat, who came to pick her up in his father's sports car, the transmission of which he destroyed on a drive they took to Montreux. And there was an Algerian in his early 20s who worked as a waiter at a restaurant near the school. She slept with the diplomat's son, whereas the Algerian, who was genuinely in love with her, she only allowed to kiss her. Because he had grown up poor like Camus, she projected onto him a fantasy. But when he had nothing to say about the son he was raised under, she began to lose those feelings for him. It sounds cold, but later I experienced this myself, the sudden disassociation that comes with the fear of realizing how intimate you have been with someone who is not at all what you imagined, but something other, entirely unknown. So when the banker demanded that Zoria drop both her diplomat son and the Algerian, it was not difficult for her to comply. It excused her of responsibility for the Algerian's pain. That morning, before we left for school, the telephone rang. When she cut things off with each of these lovers, the banker instructed she was to wear a skirt with nothing on underneath. She told us that this as we crossed the frozen field on our way to the bus stop, and we laughed. But then Zoria stopped and cupped her lighter from the wind. In the brightness of the flame, I caught her eyes, and for the first time I felt afraid for her. Or afraid of her, maybe. Afraid of what she lacked or of what she possessed that drove her beyond the place where others would draw the line. Zoria had to call the banker from the payphone at school at certain times of the day, even if it meant excusing herself in the middle of class. When she arrived at the Hotel Royal for one of their meetings, an envelope would be waiting for her at the front desk, containing elaborate instructions for what she was to do when she entered their room. I don't know what happened if she failed to follow the banker's rules or follow them to his exacting standards. It didn't occur to me that she might allow herself to be punished. Barely out of childhood, I think what I understood then, however simply, was that she was engaged in a game. A game that at any moment she could have refused to go on playing. That she, of all people, knew how easily rules could be broken, but that she elected in this instance to follow them. What could I have understood then about that? I don't know. Just as 30 years later, I don't know if what I saw in her eyes when the flame illuminated them was perversity or recklessness or fear or its opposite, the unyielding nature of her will. During the Christmas break, Marie flew to Boston. I went to stay with my family in Basel, and Zoria went home to Paris. When we returned 2 weeks later, something had changed in Zoria. She seemed withdrawn, closed up in herself, and she spent her time in bed listening to her Walkman, reading books in French, or smoking out the window. Whenever the phone rang, she jumped up to answer it, and when it was for her, she shut the door, and sometimes she didn't come out for hours. Marie came to my room more and more often because, she said, being around Zoria gave her the creeps. As we lay together in my narrow bed, Marie would tell me stories about Bangkok, and however full of drama they were, she could still laugh at herself and make me laugh. Looking back, I think that she taught me something, that however many times I have forgotten and remembered it since then, has never really left me. Something about the absurdity, and also the truth, of the dramas we need to feel fully alive. From January, then, until April, what I mostly remember are the things that were happening to me. Kate, the American girl I became close with, who lived in a large house in the neighborhood of Champelle, showed me her father's collection of Playboy. The young daughter of Mrs. Elderfield's neighbor, whom I sometimes babysat, and who one night sat up in bed screaming when she saw a praying mantis on the wall, lit by the headlights of a car. My long walks after school. The weekends in Basel where I would entertain my little sister with games to distract her from my parents' arguments. And Sharif, a boy in my class with an easy smile, with whom I walked to the lake one afternoon and made out on a bench. It was the first time I'd kissed a boy, and when he pushed his tongue into my mouth, the feeling it ignited was both tender and violent. I dug my nails into his back, and he kissed me harder. We writhed together on the bench like the couples I'd sometimes watch from afar. On the tram ride home, I could smell him on my skin, and a feeling of horror took hold of me at the thought of having to see him again in school the next day. When I did, I looked past him as if he didn't exist, but with my gaze softly focused so that I could still see the blur of his hurt in the corner of my eye. Of that time I remember, too, how once I came home from school and found Soria in the bathroom, doing her makeup in front of the mirror. Her eyes were shining, and she seemed happy and light again, as she hadn't been for weeks. She called me in and wanted to brush and braid my hair. Her cassette player was balanced on the edge of the bathtub, and while her fingers worked through my hair, she sang along. And then, when she turned to reach for a hairpin behind her, I saw the purple bruise on her throat. And yet, I never really doubted her strength, never doubted that she was in control and doing what she wanted, playing a game according to rules she had agreed to, if not invented. Only looking back do I realize how much I wanted to see her that way, strong-willed and free, invulnerable and under her own command. From my walks alone in Geneva, I already understood that the power to attract men, when it comes, arrives with a terrifying vulnerability. But I wanted to believe that the balance of power could be tipped in one's favor by strength or fearlessness or something. Something I couldn't name. Soria told us that soon after things began with the banker his wife had called on the hotel phone, and he'd instructed Soria to go into the bathroom. But she'd refused and instead lay listening on the bed. The naked banker turned his back, but he had no choice other than to go on talking to his wife, whose call he hadn't expected. He spoke to her in Dutch, Soria said, but in the same tone that the men in her own family spoke to their mothers, gravely, with a touch of fear. And, as she listened, she knew something had been exposed that he had not wished to expose, and which shifted the balance between them. I preferred that story to trying to understand the bruise on Soria's neck. It was the first week of May when she didn't return home. Mrs. Elderfield woke us up at dawn, demanding that we tell her whatever we knew about Soria's whereabouts. Marie shrugged and looked at her chipped nail polish, and I tried to follow her cue until Mrs. Elderfield said that she was going to call both Soria's parents and the police, and that if something had happened to her, if she was in danger and we were withholding any information, we wouldn't be forgiven or be able to forgive ourselves. Marie looked scared, and seeing her face, I began to cry. A few hours later, the police arrived, alone, with the detective and his partner in the kitchen. I told them everything I knew, which I realized as I spoke, losing the thread, confusing myself, was not so much. Once they had interrogated Marie, they went to the back bedroom and combed through Soria's things. Afterward, it looked as if the bedroom had been ransacked. Everything, even her underwear, strewn across the floor and her bed with an air of violation. That night, the second night that Soria was missing, there was a huge storm. Marie and I lay awake in my bed, neither one of us speaking of the things we feared. In the morning, the crunch of gravel under the wheels of a car woke us up, and we jumped out of bed to look out the window. But when the door of the taxi opened, it was a man who emerged, his lips drawn tight below his heavy black mustache. In the familiar features of Soria's father, some truth about her origins was revealed, exposing the illusion of her autonomy. Mrs. Elderfield made us repeat to Mr. Sassani the things that we'd already told the police. He was a tall and intimidating man. His face knotted in anger, and I think she wasn't brave enough to do it herself. In the end, Marie, emboldened by her new authority and the sensational quality of the news she had to deliver, did most of the talking. Mr. Sassani listened in silence, and it was impossible to say whether what he felt was fear or fury. Both, it must have been. He turned toward the door. He wanted to go to the Hotel Royal immediately. Mrs. Elderfield tried to calm him. She repeated what was already known, that the banker had checked out 2 days before, the room had been searched, nothing had been turned up. The police were doing everything they could. The banker had rented a car that they were working to track down. The only thing to do was stay here and wait until there was some news. In the hours that followed, Mr. Sassani paced grimly in front of the windows of the living room. As the royal engineer to the Shah, he must have insured against all kinds of collapse. But then the Shah himself had fallen, and the vast and intricate structure of Mr. Sassani's life had crumbled, making a mockery of the physics of safety. He'd sent his daughter to Switzerland because of its promise to restore order and safety. But then the Shah himself had fallen, and the vast and intricate structure of Mr. Sassani's life had crumbled, making a mockery of the physics of safety. He'd sent his daughter to Switzerland because of its promise to restore order and safety. But even Switzerland hadn't kept Zororia safe, and this betrayal appeared to be too much for him. At any moment, it seemed he might shout out or cry out. In the end, Zororia came home on her own. On her own. Just as she had gotten into it on her own, of her own choosing. Crossing the newly green field that evening, arriving at the door disheveled but whole, her eyes were bloodshot, and the makeup around them was smeared, but she was calm. She didn't even express surprise at the sight of her father, only winced when he shouted her name, the last syllable muffled by a gasp or sob. He lunged for her, and for a moment it seemed that he was going to yell or raise his hand to her, but she didn't flinch, and instead he pulled her to him and embraced her, his eyes filled with tears. He spoke to her urgently, angrily in Farsi, but she had said little back. She was tired, she said in English. She needed to sleep. In a voice unnaturally high, Mrs. Elderfield asked if she wanted anything to eat. Zororia shook her head as if there were nothing any more that any of us could offer that she needed, and turned toward the long corridor that led to the back bedroom. As she passed me, she stopped, reached out her hand, and touched my hair. And then, very slowly, she continued on her way. The next day, her father took her back to Paris. I don't remember if we said goodbye. I think we thought, Marie and I, that she would come back, that she would return to finish the school year and tell us everything. But she never did. She left it to us to decide for ourselves what had happened to her. And in my mind, I saw her in that moment when she touched my hair with a sad smile and believed that what I'd seen was a kind of grace, the grace that comes of having pushed oneself to the brink, of having confronted some darkness of fear and won. At the end of June, my father finished his fellowship and, expert in trauma, moved us back to New York. The mean girls took an interest in me when I returned to school in September and wanted to befriend me. At a party, one of them turned a circle around me while I stood calmly, very still. She marveled at how I'd changed and at my clothes that I had brought abroad. I had gone out into the world and come back, and though I wasn't saying anything, they sensed that I knew things. For a while, Marie sent me cassettes on which she'd recorded herself talking to me, telling me all that was happening in her life. But eventually they stopped arriving and we lost touch too. And that was the end of Switzerland for me. In my mind, that was also the end of Zororia. As I said, I never saw her again and tried to look for her only once, the summer I was 19 and living in Paris. Even then, I barely tried, calling two Sassani families who were listed in the phone book, and then giving up. And yet, if it hadn't been for her, I don't know what. I don't know that I would have got on the motorcycle of the young man who washed dishes at the restaurant across the street from my apartment on the Rue de Chevaux, and ridden back with him to his apartment on the outskirts of the city, or gone to a bar with the older man who lived on the floor below me, who went on about the job I knew he would never get for me, at the nightclub he managed, and then, when we got back to our building, lunged at me on the landing in front of his door, tackling me in an embrace. I watched a movie on the dishwasher's sofa, and afterward he told me it was dangerous to go home with men I didn't know, and drove me back to my apartment in silence. And somehow, I broke free of the nightclub manager and raced up another floor to the safety of my own apartment, though for the rest of the summer I was terrified of running into him, and listened for his comings and goings before I worked up the courage to open my door and bolt down the stairs. I told myself that I did these things because I was in Paris to practice my French and had resolved to speak to anyone who would speak to me. But all summer I was aware that Sororia might be near, somewhere in that city, that I was close to her and close to something in myself that drew me and frightened me a little, as she had. She had gone further than anyone I knew in a game that was never only a game, one that was about power and fear, about the refusal to comply with the vulnerabilities one is born into. But I myself wasn't able to go very far with it. I didn't have the courage, and after that summer I was never again so bold or so reckless. I had one boyfriend after another, all of them gentle and a little afraid of me, and then I got married and had two daughters of my own. The older has my husband's sandy hair. If she were walking in a field in autumn, you could lose her easily. But the younger one stands out wherever she is. She grows and develops in contrast with everything around her. It's wrong, dangerous even, to imagine that a person has any choice in her looks. And yet, I'd swear that my daughter had something to do with the black hair and green eyes that always attract attention, even when she's standing in a chorus of other children. She's only 12 and still small, but already men look at her when she walks in the street or rides the subway. And she doesn't hunch, or put up her hood, or hide away behind her headphones the way her friends do. She stands erect and still like a queen, which only makes her more an object of their fascination. She has a proudness about her that refuses to grow small. But if it were only that I might not have begun to fear, for her. It's her curiosity about her own power, its reach and its limits, that scares me. Though maybe the truth is that when I am not afraid for her, I envy her. One day I saw it, how she looked back at the man in the business suit who stood across the subway car from her, burning a hole through her with his eyes. Her stare was a challenge. If she'd been riding with a friend, she might have turned her face slowly toward her without taking her eyes off the man and said something to invoke laughter. It was then that Sororia came back to me, and since then I have been what I can only call haunted by her. By her, and by how a person can happen to you, and only half a lifetime later does this happening ripen, burst, and deliver itself. Sororia, with her downy mustache and her winged eyeliner and her laugh, that deep laugh that came from her stomach when she told us about the Dutch banker's arousal. He could have broken her in two with one hand, but either she was already broken or she wasn't going to break. Next, from the September 7th, 2020 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the critics section, A Critic at Large. These Four Walls, Living Indoors, by Jill Lepore. Porcupines like to live alone, but in winter they sometimes hole up in long-snouted little gangs inside hollow trees and logs, in cavities made by cracks in boulders, beneath piles of brush, or under your front porch, as sneaky as thieves. A gang of porcupines is called, magnificently, a prickle. They hardly ever venture out. Inside, in the damp and ratty dark, fallen-out quills carpet the floor. In spring, female porcupines raise their babies in those dens. A baby porcupine is called a Porky Pit. There isn't a word for porcupine den, but I humbly propose calling it a quiver, except when it's a nursery, then it's a pokey. The animal kingdom is a densely settled city-state of hives, burrows, lairs, nests, webs, caves, pits, and dens. Lodgings come in all sizes and for every length of stay. No security deposit required, from a grotty single bed for the night to fancy permanent quarters for a colony. Quivers are generally a mess. Porcupines are rodents, an order of mammals that are, as a rule, unkempt. The celebrated insouciance of the honey badger, a weasel, is nothing to the equanimity of the porcupine. Porcupines are fully armed, near blind, and imperturbable. They leave their scat outside their front door, piling up. They don't care who sniffs them out. Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont used to offer bounties to hunters. 50 cents a snout, 40 cents for a pair of ears, 25 cents for every pair of feet. But since that practice ended decades ago, porcupines have had few predators, aside from the sort of dog that's too dunderheaded to know any better, which, I confess, forlornly describes every cur of my acquaintance. Porcupines in their dens aren't really hiding, they're just staying snug, in homes they haven't so much built as come by, like squatters, or Goldilocks, or Airbnbers, lovers of the great indoors. In the Encyclopedia of Animal Accommodations, the most admirable architect is the beaver. Beavers build lodges out of sticks and mud, complete with ventilation and underground entrances. Domesticated animals live in houses built by people. Etymologically, that's what it means to be domesticated, from cow barns to pig pens. One reason some people don't eat meat is that on big farms, animals are forced to spend so much time crowded together indoors. Factory-farmed chickens, raised in giant sheds, stacked with thousands of cages, 10 to a cage the size of a file drawer, don't even have room to spread their wings, and most spend every last miserable moment of their lives inside. That only started in the 1950s, and recently, lots of people have gone back to raising their own chickens. Since the quarantine, there has been a rush on chicks and backyard coops. Enthusiasts who have never met a hen are well advised to read Betty McDonald's 1945 memoir, The Egg and I, in which she recounts, "By the end of the second spring, I hated everything about the chicken but the egg." A do-it-yourself coop consists of a roof, a roost, and nesting boxes. Translucent roofing is recommended, the idea apparently being that if chickens can see the sky, they'll forget that they're indoors. Chickens like to roost inside at night, but among the many reasons for letting them out during the day is that otherwise they might peck one another to death. That's what it means to be cooped up. The Italians call free-range chickens polli ruspanti. A wandering chicken is a happy chicken. People are no longer ruspanti. We build lean-tos and huts and shanties and houses and motels and condominiums and apartment buildings. Lately, we've been stuck in them like a prickle in a quiver, chickens in a coop, bears in a den, waiting out our desolate hibernation. Even before the quarantine, Americans and Europeans spent about 90% of their time indoors, as Joseph G. Allen and John D. McComber report in Healthy Buildings, How Indoor Spaces Drive Performance and Productivity, published by Harvard. Homes, cars, prisons, schools, buses, factories, trains, airplanes, offices, museums, hospitals, stores, restaurants. How much of your life have you spent indoors, not counting the quarantine? Multiply your age by 0.9. If you're 40, you've spent 36 hours of your years indoors. About a third of that time is spent sleeping. But still, most humans who live in the United States and Europe spend more time indoors than some species of whale spend underwater. It may be that the minutes you spend walking to and from the subway on a Tuesday in January tallied up to fewer minutes than a whale spent on the surface filling its lungs that same day. This trend won't reverse itself after the pandemic ends. Unlike the outdoor world, the indoor world is expanding, the journalist Emily Anthes reports in The Great Indoors, The Surprising Science of How Buildings Shape Our Behavior, Health, and Happiness, by Farrar Straus, published by Farrar Straus and Giroux. Quote, over the next 40 years, the United Nations estimates the total amount of indoor square footage will roughly double worldwide, end quote. Nevertheless, the indoors is the poor stepchild of the outdoors, at least in terms of environmental activism and regulation. Staying indoors, long before our present woes, was not always and not even very often a choice, including for school children, prisoners, factory and office workers, and hospital patients. Entire cities sometimes shut down. In 2018, China issued stay indoors warnings for 79 cities owing to air pollution. And from Los Angeles to Shanghai, air quality has sometimes been so bad that the elderly are advised to stay inside, and at schools, recess is canceled. But how much better is it behind closed doors? For all the attention paid to outdoor pollution, Allen and McComber point out most people experience outdoor pollution while they're inside. It seeps in. And yet the indoor environment, which produces its own toxins, is subject to very few rules. Allen teaches at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and McComber teaches at Harvard Business School. Lately, they've been preparing reports and providing advice on whether and how to safely reopen schools. Healthy Buildings advises businesses about how to make their buildings more salubrious, on the back of the investor-directed argument that healthier buildings make for more productive employees and more profitable companies. The Nine Foundations of a Healthy Building, a report from Allen's lab, advocates close control over air quality, dust, and pests, lighting and views, moisture, noise, safety and security, thermal health, ventilation, and water quality. Allen and McComber want to establish national standards, and they make a series of precise and persuasive recommendations for everything from insulation and window shades to water filters and vacuum cleaners. Having a roof over your head is one thing. A home is a human right. Living almost entirely indoors is something else. The great confinement varies by place and by wealth, and historically it's new. Over several millennia, humans have evolved from an outdoor species into an indoor one, Allen and McComber write. Citing E.O. Wilson, they explain, we evolved in the Africa savannah's wide open expanses, intimate with nature and seeking protection under tree canopies. And so our genetic hardwiring, built over millennia, still craves that connection to nature. To satisfy this craving, photographs of redwoods adorn hospital waiting rooms. You can pop into the Grand Canyon via Zoom. I used to think these dodges were better than nothing, but I've changed my mind. Zoom is usually not better than nothing. Velux, a Danish company, calls the 21st century human being the indoor generation and ascribes a plague of depression and disease to the stuffiness and dampness and mold and darkness of living indoors. The company sells skylights, the kind of thing you're supposed to put in chicken coops to stop your chickens from going stir-crazy. Its website features a spooky M. Night Shyamalan-style video of a pale and sickly little girl explaining, "It all started the day we left nature behind. We feathered our nests with espresso machines and flat-screen televisions and Spotify. Our homes become places you would never want to leave," the girl says, the shadows under her eyes grown darker. "But we had closed ourselves in to a point where nothing could get out. We started getting sick, itchy, coughy, sleepless. Many of us even started to feel sad, and that was in the before time." If industry was the watchword of building design in the 19th century, and efficiency the watchword in much of the 20th, wellness has been the watchword of the 21st century. Wellness is a swindle. Many of the architectural experiments chronicled and the building design reforms advocated in the great outdoor, indoors, and healthy buildings advance an anti-universal, hyper-individualized medical model in which architecture is seen as therapeutic, building by building and person by person. Allen and McComber date the origin of their field to the 1980s, when people began talking about sick building syndrome, defined in the dictionary as a set of symptoms such as headache, fatigue, and eye irritation, typically affecting workers in a modern, airtight office buildings that is believed to be caused by indoor pollutants, such as formaldehyde fumes or microorganisms. Anthes, who describes herself as unapologetically indoorsy, embraces the possibility of building design as a cure-all. Quote, "The promise of improving our health and extending our lifespans, even just a little, without ever leaving the house? Well, I found that idea irresistible," end quote. She visits schools and apartment buildings specially designed to address aging, obesity, and depression. She gamely reports on smart offices and smart homes and floating cities and proposed villages on the moon and the new field of indoor ecology, the study of subjects like the mites to be found in your pillow. Quote, "The more I read about the world of indoor microbes, the more I found myself obsessing over my own invisible roommates. I contemplated fungi as I cooked, bacteria as I bathed," she writes. "I began to feel like a stranger in my own home, humbled by how little I knew about what was happening under my roof," end quote. The recommendations of that research? Open a window, get a dog. Building design is also increasingly driven by personal data, collected and held as a commodity and used to improve business performance and productivity. Ethical objections to this type of data collection, suspended during the pandemic, are unlikely to recover their strength when it's over, which means that if you ever go back to the office, you may be monitored in ways you used to consider a violation of your rights. Are better designed buildings the solution to all that ails the indoor generation? The wellness model is not without its critics, who include Giovanna Borassi and Mirko Zardini, the curators of a 2011 exhibit at the Canadian Center for Architecture in Montreal, and the editors of an accompanying book of essays called Imperfect Health, The Medicalization of Architecture. Quote, "An ever-increasing number of urban environmental and architectural problems are treated as medical, and remedies are sought for increasingly specific solutions," Borassi and Zardini write. "Tailoring requirements to particular groups of ill or presumably ill individuals leads to conflicting, contradictory solutions, and finally, to even greater segregation of various demographic groups," end quote. Fighting disease is a public health crusade. Leading a healthier life is, very often, a private one. Or rather, it was. It isn't anymore. A pandemic upends everything, including the relationship between the private and the public, the rich and the poor, the city and the country, and the outdoors and the indoors. The coronavirus acts like a miasma and a germ all at once. It's in the air, it's on surfaces, it's inside us. There is nothing so wild as a virus, and yet no creature so relentless in its search for a home, no matter how unwelcoming the host. Meanwhile, living indoors all the time is driving people crazy. Staring at the wallpaper, peering out windows, craving nature and one another, whimpering and howling inside. No one knows for certain where the COVID-19 virus came from, but one murky, unconfirmed theory has it that a pangolin, dragged from its den, caught in a snare, or tracked by a dog, contracted the virus from a live bat, a winged mammal that sleeps upside down in places where even the days are dark. Chimneys, caverns, crevices in the rocks. A colony of bats is sometimes called a camp, as if they'd pitched tents. Pangolins are anteaters, nocturnal and reclusive, scaly, long-snouted, near-blind, and solitary. They are not altogether unlike porcupines. Their scales protect them from stings and bites, and when a lion or a tiger comes near, they curl up into a ball, like a prickly burr. Females give birth in dens. Pangolin babies cling to their mother's tail with their sharp-clawed, five-toed paws, much the way a koala joey clutches its mother's shoulders. Before China shut down, the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market in Wuhan Province in January, a wildlife section there sold live porcupines, beavers, snakes, badgers, and possibly pangolins. Maybe a pangolin or some other wild animal contracted the virus from a bat in the market, where peddlers stacked all sorts of animals in cages, cramped, wretched, filthy, desperate, in stall after stall, as if they had built a little city, half outdoors, half indoors, a mayhem. Well, we have time for a cartoon. In this cartoon, a man and his wife, or a woman, are in bed. The man has a laptop computer. He's typing on it. There's a small dog at the foot of the bed. The man is looking at the clock, and the man says, "Wow, it's only 11. That still leaves me time for me to ruin tomorrow by staying up doing nothing on the Internet." In the next cartoon, the catcher and pitcher are in a baseball stadium, and they are on the mound having a discussion while the batter is at the plate. And the catcher says to the pitcher, "You must get this all the time, but I have a great idea for how to strike him out." The last cartoon is called Nature Corner, and there are two praying mantises standing up talking to each other, and one of them says, "And after they have sex, they spend the next 50 years arguing about how to load the dishwasher. It's so disgusting." Well, we've run out of time for another episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed listening to it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Would love to hear from you. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.